this morning. This is, as I said last week and I said in the email when I sent out the materials, this is going to be a bit of an extended session. Those who have to leave at 11, you know, of course, will do so. But I wanted to make sure to cover both Don Isaac Abarbanel and Dona Gracia, and I had to leave early last time because of the funeral, so we're making up for it today. And as always, I expect to send out a link to the audio recording later on, and so those who have to leave at 11 will still be able to catch the rest of it via the recording. So I just put the link in the chat again for the source sheet, and we're on our way, first with Don Isaac Abarbanel. I should note our session today is dedicated for the yahrzeit of Alexander ben Devorah Rafael Yosef by his daughter Devorah. So he should benefit from the learning that we do. Don Isaac Abarbanel. First of all, just to note, the name Abarbanel is written in a range of different ways. Sometimes you see it written as Abarbanel, Abrabanel, Abravanel. It's all the same person. It's all fine. We're talking again, as with Ramban, with Nachmanides, as with Shmuel HaNagid, about somebody who was both a religious scholar and a political leader. We're going to talk about Abarbanel himself, as well as his life as it fits with the Jews of his day, the turn of the 16th century, the Jews who were expelled from Christian Spain. And we'll also talk after that about the Jews who did not leave, who were not expelled, but instead lived undercover as Christians, when we talk about Dona Gracia. So we're going to get to an awful lot, I hope, today. I want to begin looking at Abarbanel by pointing you to the first source on the source sheet. And because I keep letting people in, I need to repost the link in the chat for the source sheet for those who just joined. If you take a look at the first source on the sheet, this comes from Rabbi Yosef Karo, who we learned about when we did the Kabbalists of Tzfat, from his Beit Yosef commentary to the tour. So he is writing this in the middle of the 16th century, and at this point, Don Isaac Abarbanel has already passed away for a good 50 years. But he talks about a certain question that was asked, a question of Jewish law. And he says, this question was asked in the Academy of the Light of the Exile of Ariel. The Exile of Ariel, Ariel is a term for the temple in Jerusalem. So this question was asked in the Academy of the one who was the light of the Jewish exile, the great one, our mentor, Rabbi Isaac Abohav. We actually talked about him a little bit last year. When we talked about the Jews in the New World, and there were two different Rabbi Isaac Abohav, so this is one of them. The question was asked in his study hall in a great public gathering of sages and scholars, including the Great Eagle, our mentor Rabbi Isaac Abarbanel, may his memory live in the next world. So Rabbi Yosef Karo, himself a giant as a codifier of Jewish law, as a mystic, as a leader in general, Rabbi Karo identifies Don Isaac Abarbanel 50 years after his passing as the Great Eagle. Now, I should note he didn't use the word eagle. He wasn't writing in English. He used the term nesher. So nesher often gets translated as eagle, although from a pure ornithological standpoint, it may well refer to a species of vulture. Worth being aware of that has to do with how the commentators describe the placement of the talons on the claw of this creature called the Nesher. It's actually very funny because the Nesher appears in the Torah first when the Jews are taken out of Egypt and God says, I will carry you on the wings of the Nesher, right? Al kanfei nesharim. And then it appears in the list of non-kosher birds. So if you were to look in a Sansino Chumash, you would find that when it talks about the Jews being carried on the wings of the Nesher, it translates Nesher as eagle. However, if you look at when it appears in Leviticus chapter 9 or 11, I think it's 11, the list of the non-kosher birds, it translates it as bearded vulture. I guess we don't want to be carried on the wings of the bearded vulture. I guess that, yeah, the image just doesn't really work for us. On the wings of vultures. In any case, he's using Nesher here. I'm sorry?
What is the question?
The question has to do with when the sages describe the signs of a non-kosher bird, one of the signs has to do with the placement of the talons on the feet of certain predatory birds. And the way that some of the commentators describe the talons on the Nesher, remember, they're not using English. This is going back 1,000 years. They seem to describe them in a way that fits the vulture, not the eagle. So that's why the question as to what the Nesher actually is. It's a side note in terms of our discussion. The main point here is the image of the Nesher as a protective bird. We're being carried on the wings of the Nesher is what is being channeled when Rabbi Caro calls Don Isaac Abarbanel the great eagle, the great Nesher. He's saying Don Isaac Abarbanel was a great protector for the Jewish world, and he was present at the lecture in this great academy where there was this discussion of Jewish law going on. That's really the point here. Now, I gave you a map on the sheet. The map is probably familiar to everybody here, but, you know, as somebody who grew up in the U.S. and hasn't really traveled beyond Israel and Canada, so for me it's useful as a way to remember things. It's just a map of the northern Mediterranean coast. Because when we talk about Abarbanel, we talk about a lot of traveling. So you see on the map, you see Spain and Portugal in the west, and then you see Italy, and then you move towards Greece, and then finally Turkey. So today we are going to span all of those places. Abarbanel does not go to Turkey. Dona Gracia goes to Turkey. So we've got a lot of traveling to do here. In source number 3 on the sheet, I gave you a list of what I call the kings of Abarbanel. These are the kings with whom he had relationships of one kind or another. So the first is because, as we're going to see, he's born in Lisbon, in Portugal, at the time when Alfonso V is the king of Portugal. Then John II takes over from Alfonso. At that point, he ends up leaving Portugal and going to Spain. The king in Spain is the famous or infamous Ferdinand II, the one who expels the Jews from Spain. And then from there, he ends up in Naples under Ferdinand I, who is not the father of Ferdinand II. I really would understand a lot of European history a lot better if they would get their act together in terms of how they named their kings. It's really very frustrating, just speaking personally. But in any case, those are the names of kings who we're going to be talking about. Clear so far? We're good? Okay. So Don Isaac Abarbanel, as I said, is born in Lisbon in Portugal in the year 1437. I gave you that at the top of the sheet where I, you know, first mentioned him. So it's there on the page. His family claimed to be from the line of King David, from that line which, you know, were the monarchs of the Jewish people. They were financial leaders, they were political leaders, leaders in the Jewish community in the Iberian Peninsula. So that there was, going back to the year 1306, there was Don Judah Abarbanel. The title of Don is a title of nobility that was inherited. So when Rabbi Isaac Abarbanel is known as Don Isaac Abarbanel, it's a title that he inherited in the family. So Don Judah Abarbanel lived in Seville, he actually underwrote loans of money, fabric, biscuits for the Christian forces in a war between the Christians and the Muslims in a port in Spain. He was lending to the government there. Don Isaac Abarbanel's grandfather was Don Samuel Abarbanel, and he was the chief accountant to Spanish royalty. He was also a generous supporter of Jewish learning. But you have to know that when you had situations in which Jews came into power, that did not insulate them from anti-Semitism. We saw with Shmuel HaNagid the dance between those who were a threat to him and his the challenges that he faced. Well, on March 15th in the year 1391, also known as Ash Wednesday, a mob attacked Seville, killing 4,000 Jews. This was a Christian mob. The majority of the Jews who lived in Seville converted converted to Christianity, including Samuel Abarbanel. He lived as a Christian under the name Juan Sanchez de Seville for 3 years. After 3 years, he returned to identifying publicly as a Jew. The price for being able to do that was that he had to give his fortune to the government. This was Abarbanel's grandfather. His grandfather went on, though, to continue to be influential. In the year 1418, he goes to speak to Pope Martin V about attacks on Jews and desecration of synagogues, and Pope Martin V actually issued a decree banning attacks on Jews in their synagogues, banning baptism by force, saying that there was to be no expansion of the requirements for the Jewish badge, no hindering of Jewish businesses. This wasn't because Martin V loved Jews. Don't kid yourself. There are two motivations that historians bring for this. One was the Great Schism in the church at that time. There was a pope and there was an anti-pope. It was a big mess in the church at the time. And so it's possible that Pope Martin was trying to get support of the Jews for support financially for his forces in terms of dealing with anti-Pope Benedict. That's one possibility. The other possibility was just straight, that it was for financial bribes, really, was what it was about. But that was Abarbanel's grandfather, who you see had this very tumultuous existence. His father, Don Isaac Abarbanel's father, Judah, moved to Portugal, was treasurer to a Portuguese prince, and was also a very benevolent man, a leader within the community. And that brings us to Don Isaac Abarbanel. Life in Portugal for him in his early years wasn't bad, as long as Alfonso V was king. Alfonso V was really the one of the kings to oversee a golden age for Jews. Jews in Portugal at that time did reasonably well. The code of laws in Portugal at the time was harsh against Jews. However, Alfonso V was not interested in enforcing those laws. So the Jews in Portugal were technically required to wear a badge, but they didn't do so, and Alfonso let it go. The Jews were led by a chief rabbi and 7 provincial rabbis who were protected during Alfonso's reign. Jews were allowed to print public documents in Hebrew. Remember last summer we talked about censorship of Jewish books. They were allowed to print their documents in Hebrew. The princes of the church even appointed Jewish receivers of church taxes. In other words, Jews were allowed to collect taxes on behalf of the church. Not all the Christian community was happy with that, but that existed. Like, Jews actually did all right at this stage. So in that environment, young Isaac grows up with a Jewish education as well as a secular education. He learns philosophy. He studies what passes for science back in those days. He wrote something called Surat HaYesodot about the natural elements that comprise the universe. He wrote essays about Jewish thought, and he fills his father's shoes as the treasurer to Alfonso V of Portugal. That's his initial professional role. I gave you on the sheet, if you're looking at the sheet in source number 4, I gave you some outline to be able to follow with this of just, you know, some of the highlights, because I realize it's just a lot of material. Abarbanel is not only a leader for the Jews in Portugal, he becomes a protector of Jews elsewhere as well. So in the year 1471, Abarbanel at this point is 34 years old. Alfonso V captures provinces in North Africa. 250 Jews are captured and are going to be sold into slavery. Abarbanel raises the funds and uses his influence to instead ransom them and have them be released. It's thought that that was when he earned the title, the Great Eagle, that Rabbi Caro gave him, was for his success in saving the Jews from North Africa. Well, unfortunately, as we just saw regarding his grandfather, in Europe of this time, power and influence will only take you so far. In the year 1483, King John II, João is his Portuguese name, succeeds Alfonso. And his mission is to try to rid himself of Portuguese nobles. He felt threatened by the Portuguese nobility. And so he basically purges them. And he accuses Abarbanel of conspiracy as part of the nobility against the throne. And at that point, Abarbanel flees and his fortune is confiscated. Now, that was the year 1483. Jewish life in Portugal would later end, basically, in the year 1496, 1497. We're going to come back to that when we talk about Dona Gracia. Are we clear so far? Am I going too fast? You should know you have the option on the Zoom here, under reactions, to do arrows for slower and faster. I can't say I'll respond, but you can have the option. It'll make you feel better. So we've now seen Abarbanel leave Portugal. He goes to Spain. Well, historically, the government was ambivalent toward Jews. We talked about that in the 13th century when we talked about Nachmanides last week. Now we're going to see it in terms of this later period of time, the end of the 15th century. There were times when Jews had to wear a badge. There were times when Jews had restrictions on the names they used. But they always ran into trouble, those who wanted to persecute the Jews, because the Jews had capital. They had connections financially with other countries in trade. They had the ability to engage in money lending, which had all sorts of restrictions, you know, in different aspects of society, within Christian society, within Muslim society, within Jewish society. There were all sorts of issues, but the Jews ended up being the middleman between the Christians and the Muslims, often. In the 1470s, as we discussed last week, remember the map that we had showing the Reconquista, the Christian conquest of Spain in stages from the Muslims? So in the 1470s, Spain becomes almost entirely Christian. The marriage of Isabella of Castilla and Ferdinand II, who is from Aragon, unifies much of Spain under their control. That becomes very important. It essentially sets the stage for the expulsion from Spain. Pausing our look at the overall conditions, Don Isaac Abarbanel at this time is living in Toledo. He spends his time when he arrives in Spain learning Torah, writing commentaries to the biblical books of Joshua, Judges, and Samuel, Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel. He gets a position with a banking firm, and he continues to write. However, Ferdinand and Isabella realize what they have there, and they take him to collect revenue and to supply military provisions. And they prosper under his 8 years in office, from 1484, of course, 1492. Abarbanel says, in his own writings, I did really well under my service to the king. I got land, I got estates, he rebuilds his fortune. He even lends the government money for their war in Granada in southern Spain as they're fighting against the last holdouts of Islam within Spain. I see a note in the chat about a book that may be of interest, which won the Canadian Jewish Literary Award, so you can take a look at that. So Abarbanel is doing a lot here. He has a lot of influence with the government. This was a time when the Dominican Order, which had been formed in order to enforce church decrees across Europe, the Dominicans were accusing the Jews of violating the laws that were meant to restrict Jewish activity and of doing things against Christians. They allege that the Jews in one community had shown disrespect to a cross. In another town, they said the Jews had stolen and crucified a Christian child. And every time this came up, Abarbanel weighed in to protect the Jews. But then you get to Ferdinand and Isabella and the expulsion. Ferdinand and Isabella conquered Granada in the south of Spain, and that completed the Reconquista, the taking of Spain for the Christians. If you take a look on your sheet, if you move to source number 5, there's still more in the outline of number 4, but look at the source in number 5. This comes from I know, Moish. I figured that it would do that. Thanks for writing it in the chat. For those who aren't reading the chat, apparently the transcript renders Abarbanel as Barbie doll. That doesn't surprise me in the least. So, Don Isaac Abarbanel, in his introduction to the book of Malachim, the book of Kings, and this is not my translation, this is Davna Siegman's translation. The other translations are mine, but this I had from other materials. And in the 9th year, Abarbanel wrote, the 9th year because he served for 8 years as treasurer to the king. The king of Spain conquered all of the kingdom of Granada and the great and mighty city of Granada. And in his position of strength and of great pride, a religious spirit overtook him. And Esav said to himself, Esav is a term that Jews historically have used for the church, for Christianity. That goes back to Esav being Edom, associated with the city of Rome. Longer discussion. But Esav said to himself, how shall I appease the God who helped me in battle? What shall I offer my maker who delivered the city into my hands, other than to bring the stray sheep of Israel under his wings and restore them to the correct faith, or else expel them to another land and never allow them to return to my country or my presence? So in other words, Ferdinand and Isabella want to show gratitude to their God for helping them to fight off the Muslims in Spain, and the way they're going to do it is by forcing the Jews to convert to Christianity or leave. They sent a message to Pope Innocent VII. I told you last week, Pope Innocent is never a good sign for the Jews. Well, in this case, they send their message to Pope Innocent saying that they're willing to banish the Jews from the country, but he has to set the example first. He declined. He doesn't want to lose the Jews. He doesn't want to lose the influence. It's not because he liked us. So they decided, we're going to go ahead anyway, without the Pope's consent. He's not stopping us, so we're not going to wait. We're going to do it ourselves. Abarbanel offers the king 30,000 ducats to revoke the decree, and the legend goes that Torquemada, the inquisitor, accused the king of selling their savior for silver, just as he had been sold for 30 silver pieces. So now you're selling him again. And based on that, Ferdinand declines the 30,000 ducats. And they say, however, you can stay. They tell Abarbanel, you can stay here in Spain yourself. They would like to keep their treasurer. He refuses. He says, I'm leaving. They threaten to seize his one-year-old son, who he has sent secretly to Lisbon. They seize him. They get him as a hostage, they baptize him, and they raise him as Christian. This is his, this is Don Isaac Abarbanel's son, who's also named Isaac. Nonetheless, Abarbanel leaves. He wrote that he believed that the expulsion was part of a divine plan. This is not news. This was something that was a common idea. And specifically, some of you may have learned this with me. We did this in a class at BevMF a very long time ago, like 9 or 10 years ago. Rabbeinu Nisim, who was a little bit after the time of Nachmanides, actually suggested that God arranges wars between countries and empires in order to make sure that there will always be a place Jews can flee to. In other words, if the world were unified, where would we be able to go? But because there's always somebody against somebody else, when one side kicks us out, the other side will take us in. It's a very interesting philosophy of global politics. The answering the question in the chat, yes, he leaves his son behind. He does not get his son back. There is a legend that there was a curse that Don Isaac Abarbanel issued that Jews should not live in Spain afterwards. That's a myth. He did not issue such a curse. Susan, you had your hand up? Or did I answer it already?
It was about the child. Never?
No.
Nope. So sad.
Yes. And this was the life of Jews back in those days. This is what it meant. So when he leaves Spain, if you're following on the on the sheet in the outline, we're now turning to the second side. He went east first to the island of Corfu, off of the western coast of Greece. So if you're following the map, you can see how he's just going west to east. Then, though, he goes to Naples. Naples is the shoe of the Italian boot. And it was actually an independent kingdom led by King Ferdinand I. And again, the whole business of the different Ferdinands is very difficult to follow. But his father, this Ferdinand I, his father was Alfonso V of Aragon, who is not Alfonso V of Portugal, whom we saw before. Yes, Susan, that is exactly what I was doing as I was trying to put all of this together. That expression, exactly. It's too bad I don't record video. He went from one Ferdinand to another Ferdinand, whose father is Alfonso V, who is a different Alfonso V. That basically sums it up. I don't understand. Why couldn't... never mind. So many Jews who had fled from provinces in Spain desired to settle in Naples. And they sent ambassadors to Ferdinand I of Naples to ask him to receive them. By the way, now you know why I gave you a list of kings on the first side. That's why I did that. So many thousands of Jews landed in the Bay of Naples on the 24th of August, 1492, and were well received. The Jewish community there welcomed them, paid for their passage, and provided them with their immediate necessities. Right? This is something that Jews have had to do over and over again in history to take care of Jews who had to arrive running from somewhere else. Well, trouble followed with a plague. Whether there was a plague because of their poverty or overcrowding on the ships is unclear. Ferdinand gets scared because he says, the local population, if they think the Jews are plague-ridden, are going to rebel against having the Jews here. He makes them bury their dead by night and in silence to try to minimize public awareness of what's going on. But there's a campaign to expel the Jews that is brought before Ferdinand. He threatens to abdicate if the Jews are attacked. He says, I am protecting them. A very different Ferdinand, as you can see. He had hospitals built for them outside the town. He sent physicians to their aid. He gave them means of support. So this is, again, you get sometimes kings who are going to be more helpful, whether that's, again, because of financial benefit or because of personal righteousness, who can say? Abarbanel's own experience in Naples. So you can imagine what a destructive thing this was for him. He left Portugal and abandoned his fortune there. He left Spain and abandoned his fortune and his influence and his son there. He is devastated at this point. And he feels like his personal experience in the expulsion is a punishment from God. You're spending too much time in the intrigues of the Spanish court. You're not spending enough time in study, in writing. And so he says, you know what? I'm not going to get involved in the royal court in Naples. I'm going to learn. I'm going to write. Keep your head down. Well, the king of Naples, this fellow Ferdinand, finds out that Abarbanel is there in the city. And he invites him to take a position once again in the financial department, hoping to make use of Abarbanel's experience. Abarbanel really doesn't have a choice, and he takes the position, but in general he seems to have taken a lower profile. Keep in mind also that at this stage he is already much further along in life, right? He's got to be, at this point, in his 60s. So it's not the same as when he was in his 30s.
Robert?
Yeah, Susan.
Abarbanel was so famous in Naples.
Yes.
So he was like, they wrote about him, or?
Yeah. I mean, he was involved at, when you're the treasurer, right? You're involved in financing things for the government. That's a position that everybody knows. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if people within the Jewish community there in Naples, knowing the position he had held, told others within Naples as well. But yeah, these were high profile positions. Random people in the non-Jewish world in another country would have known who Don Isaac Abarbanel was. So Abarbanel still, even though he's taking a position, really wants to be less in the limelight. He immerses himself in Kabbalah, interestingly, in mysticism, in his exposure to Italian learning now that he's in Naples. Previously, he had really focused on philosophy, on Tanakh, on Talmud and law. Now he's also into mysticism. Fascinatingly, Abarbanel also meets Ashkenazim here for the first time because he had lived in Portugal. He had lived in Spain. Those are solidly Sephardic lands. Italy, we talked about this in the first week when we talked about Shmuel HaNagid. Italy was the home of many Jews who went on to move to Germany and become Ashkenazim. Italy has its own identity. It's not really Ashkenazi. It's got its own thing going with its own religious identity. But there are Ashkenazi Jews who are there, and Abarbanel meets them. Abarbanel meets their rabbis, and he's not impressed. Abarbanel is not a fan. First of all, he felt that they didn't know how to learn Chumash, the Bible. He said the Ashkenazi commentators are entirely too literal. He writes, it's like they never heard the word Midrash in their lives. He's very unimpressed with the Ashkenazi approach. He says, and this is in his writings, he says, you know, Pirkei Avot tells us that you're supposed to learn Chumash. It gives us the stages at which you learn, right? So it says, Ben Chamesh LeMikra. You're supposed to learn Chumash. You're supposed to learn the Bible at age 5. So he says, these Ashkenazim think that means you only learn Chumash at the age of 5, and then you move on to other things. And they never come back to learn it with an adult mind. So what do you expect from them? He also believed that they did not write Hebrew well. He had one exception, a fellow by the name of Shaul HaKohen, but he did not approve of the way Ashkenazim wrote Hebrew. Remember, the Sephardic style was very ornate, very poetic. He says they don't know how to write Hebrew. He also didn't like the fact that Ashkenazim called every rabbi, rabbi. Remember that ordination, we talked about this last year when we talked about the Kabbalists of Tzfat. Not last year, it was in the, whenever it was that we talked about the Kabbalists of Tzfat, in November, I think. We said that smicha, true ordination, ceased during Roman times. And what replaced it was just certification of this person has studied legal texts and can answer questions in Jewish law. It's not the original ordination. So Sephardim didn't use the title rabbi for the most part. You may be familiar with the title chacham, that's a separate thing. But they didn't use the term rabbi at this stage. So Abarbanel meets these Ashkenazim and all their rabbis have the title rabbi. And he theorized that Ashkenazi use of the title rabbi was emulation of the non-Jewish titles that are given for university graduates and people with doctorates and so on. So they want to call them rabbi. Yes, Janine.
You mentioned that he was unhappy with the Ashkenazi emphasis on literal, you know,
yeah. So we're going to get to his commentary. We'll talk about his style when I get to talk about his writings. It's a good question. The French took Naples in the year 1503, and the Jews fled. So Abarbanel followed the king. It's not clear who was actually the one he went with. There's a whole bunch of intrigue there. I'm not going into that right now. But he goes through Sicily and eventually to Venice. At this point, his wealth is gone, his family is separated in their journey, and he dies in 1508 in Venice. Okay. So, a very tragic life, somebody who is doing everything he can to lead and help and teach and everything else, and just every step of the way, he is beset by problems. Let's talk about the yes, Claudette.
In all this moving around of Abernel, and he's writing commentary, how did we get, because, you know, things can get lost.
Yes, they can. And the answer is, he treasured his manuscripts, and like this was to him a vital part of his existence, and he made sure to publicize them and spread them wherever he went. And I imagine having the position that he had politically was a help in that regard. But you're right. And, you know, whenever we talk about the commentators of that, of really any time between, call it the 9th century and the 16th, 17th, 18th, we have certain books that they wrote commentaries on, but they don't have commentaries on everything. You always wonder, what did we lose? Is it possible that they wrote more commentaries on other things or partial ones and we just never got to them? Yeah, Claudette. And then
when I was in my other life, I was told that the Catholic Church has a lot of the writings of some of the people that they see.
Yes. And we found that over time. There have been manuscripts that only the Vatican had, and it's alleged that there is much more, and it's indeed possible. Susan?
Do we have any idea how this affected him personally? Like, did he become bitter, blame God?
So, what I already mentioned that he viewed a lot of this as divine punishment for him. We also see that he becomes very despondent, but some of it is going to emerge in what we talk about now. So, I want to talk about the expulsion in greater detail. If you take a look on the sheet, did I bring it? No, I did not bring it. I apologize. I should have brought it. But Abarbanel records that some 300,000 Jews fled from Spain rather than convert to Christianity. Other accounts disagree and say that most Jews actually stayed and converted. It's not clear. I mean, Abarbanel's record is contemporary to what's going on. On the other hand, you could argue that he has an investment in portraying the Jews as being loyal and being faithful and not converting to Christianity. Unclear to me. The Jews who leave Spain go everywhere. Some of them go to Portugal, right nearby. Some of them go to Naples. Some of them go with Columbus, right? Whether Columbus was Jewish or not is its own fun discussion that no one is ever going to have a definitive answer for. But we know that there are Jews who go with him. There are Jews who go to Ottoman-controlled Turkey. There are Jews who go east to Poland. But in all these places, they survive. They enter into often fields of finance or medicine, and they soon encounter new troubles. How did Jews survive this move economically? Well, they brought movable items where they could. They did not have cash. That was all confiscated. They often sold off assets before going and took bank drafts with them that were not honored at their destinations. In some cities, the Jews actually turned over all of their communal property to the municipal government as payment for protecting the Jewish cemeteries. So the Jews who endure this are, yes, depressed, impoverished, often plague-ridden. And it drives many of them in two different destructive directions. Some of the Jews took this as fuel for messianism. You know, we have a tradition about great wars before the time of the Messiah, the idea that there will be a Mashiach who's going to bring us back after great suffering. So this led to various false messiahs. Asher Lamelin, David Ruveni, Solomon Molcho, not Shabtai Tzvi, he's later. He's in the 1660s. On the other hand, others went the opposite direction. I see your hand, Rose. Others went the opposite direction. There's a statement in the Talmud in the volume called Sanhedrin, towards the end, by somebody known as Rabbi Hillel. This is not the same as the famous Hillel. It's a different person. But this fellow, Rabbi Hillel, says, Ein Mashiach li Yisrael. There is no Messiah for Israel. Shekvar ba, he has already arrived. And some Jews looked at that as a statement, not a Christian statement, that's not what he means, that he has already arrived. It means that we've lost all our opportunities. It's done. Marlene, thank you for your note in the chat. The idea is that it's all over for the Jews, and they said, so there is no Messiah coming for us. We're just gonna suffer in exile until we are destroyed. Abarbanel took it upon himself to combat both of those paths. He started to write his commentary on the Chumash, the Bible, the five books, on the book of Deuteronomy, because he felt that the predictions and warnings there carried strong messages for the Jews of his day. And he wrote another book called Yeshuot Mishicho, the salvations of his anointed one, of God's anointed one, about Mashiach, Abayah. And he said, Rabbi Hillel, when he said that Mashiach has already come, just means there won't be a messianic king, there will be a leader, and God will be our king. But he wasn't saying that there's no such thing as a Mashiach anymore, as a Messiah anymore. And Abarbanel even makes predictions in his writings for when he believes that Mashiach is going to come. He works on the book of Daniel, and he understands in the book of Daniel predictions the Messiah is going to come in, wait for it, the year 1502. Well, 1502 comes and goes. And then he says, oh, wait, I misread it. It's 1503. And there's a reason for it. He's not just like scratching something out and putting in a new number. It's all based on verses there and numbers that are presented in the book. And he ends up with 1503 and then 1504 and then 1505, and then he just gives up. He says, all right, fine. I don't know. But he's trying to rally the Jews in his role as a leader, even as he's dealing with his own suffering. Yes, Rose.
So, Sforno and Casita and Umberto, they were in that same time period, but they were in a different place, so they weren't together?
So Sforno, if I remember correctly, is not, yeah, he's not in that generation, I think.
I thought he was 14, maybe not.
No. Sforno and Reuchlin and King Maximilian and all of those? I don't believe
no,
so.
I thought they were in the late 1500s.
I just Google it. That's the easiest thing to do. He's born in 1470. No, he is overlapping. He's born in 1475 and he dies in 1550. Right. But he's in a different part of Italy. Remember, Italy at this point is provinces. It's not a unified country.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah, he's in a different part of Italy. Okay. So a little bit about Abarbanel's writing. He wrote on books within the Chumash, the five books, as well as the prophets and the writings, Nevi'im Uktuvim. He wrote on Jewish philosophy, fundamentals of faith. He wrote three works on Mashiach, on the Messiah. One, his commentary to the book of Daniel. Second, the Yeshuot Mishicho we mentioned before. Another one called Mashmi'a Yeshua, about the biblical passages relating to Mashiach, to the Messiah. Interesting note, Don Isaac Abarbanel's works have been banned by what you could consider both ends of the religious spectrum. On the one hand, in the year 1753, the inquisitors in Italy tried to ban all of Abarbanel's works because in one of them he expressed ideas that were offensive to Christianity. That was on the one end. In Italy in 1753, that's really remarkable. 250 years later, they're still trying to do it. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, traditionalists among Jews have at times excluded his work. He quotes Christians in his work. We'll see an example of that shortly. He doesn't always agree with the approach of the Midrash. And sometimes he just writes controversial things. Those who are in my class on Ruth on Tuesday afternoons will recognize a piece that I brought you in source number 6 from his introduction to the book of Jeremiah. In his introduction to the book of Jeremiah, he talks about the fact that there are a lot of problems in the Hebrew text of that book. Places where there seem to be one version of a word that's written in the text, another version that's spoken out loud. And he says the reason why is because the prophet Jeremiah was a great prophet, but he didn't write well, which is a quasi-heretical statement and gets him quite a bit of opposition. So he says things that are controversial like that, and that that gets him into religious hot water. Yes, Mariana.
But I thought he died in 1503.
Yes, correct. No, he died in 1508, right?
So these are books that he wrote before he died.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. But he died in 1508, just to know. Okay. His influences came from largely the Spanish-Portuguese tradition, not surprisingly. This tradition was well-versed in Tanakh, well-versed in grammar, in language, the philosophy of their host countries. There were also specific people who influenced him. When he was first starting out in Portugal, he was heavily influenced by Rabbi Yosef Chayun, who was the rabbi of Lisbon, and was a giant in Talmud study and in biblical study. And he was influenced by Maimonides. Everyone is influenced by Maimonides. At times, he defended Maimonides in the controversies about Maimonidean philosophy, but he was never fully comfortable with Maimonides' philosophy. In one place, he wrote the classic line about an idea that Maimonides expressed: "This is the intention of Rabbeinu Moshe, but not the intention of Moshe Rabbeinu." This is the intention of our master Moses, but not meaning Maimonides, but not the intention of Moses, our master, meaning the original. That's his style. He developed secular knowledge, and he used it in his commentaries. Take a look, please, at source number 7 for an example of this from his commentary to the book of Joshua. He writes, "As the chief philosopher Aristotle said in his work, The Heavens and the Universe, we must give thanks to those who came before, who began to investigate, for although they may not have discovered truth, at the least they raised the question. Had they not initiated the investigation, we would not be able to complete it." So he presents this idea, and he quotes it from Aristotle, and he has other Romans who he's familiar with, Seneca. He also has very interesting. He also picked up geography. I see your hand, Susan, just one minute. He picked up geography from the New Explorers. If you take a look at his commentary to Jeremiah in source number 8, he comments on a verse which says, in the future, the house of Judah will go to the house of Israel. And he says, you know, for a long time, people read that book, read the book of Jeremiah and didn't know what that meant. But then he says, lo and behold, through the agency of explorers who traveled from Portugal to India for spices, I received a letter from Jews living in the lands of the West who claimed to be descendants of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, who had been exiled from the cities of Judah by Sennacherib, had not returned for the second temple. Behold, the house of Judah goes to the house of Israel. So he draws on the explorers of his day. Yes, Susan.
Criticism of his secular knowledge, or was that accepted?
So no, there are those who criticize that. Yeah. Mariana.
So what are the basic rules that Maimonides installed? Is it some of the basic?
So Maimonides is really his own discussion. Maimonides is really his own discussion. Unfortunately, we can't spend time on him right now, but he was a giant in terms of Jewish law and in terms of Jewish philosophy. If you email me later, maybe I'll be able to send you a link to the series. Rabbi Sammy Bergman from my Beit Midrash offered a series on Maimonides a few months ago.
Thanks.
Sure. He's also, Abarbanel was, and I think I mentioned this before, well-versed in Christian thought. He quotes Christian writers in his commentary to biblical texts, sometimes to agree and sometimes to disagree. So as an example, take a look at source number 9 from his commentary to the book of Samuel of Shmuel. Maimonides wrote that Samuel did not prophesy before this time and did not know that this would be the format of prophecy. He's talking here about the book of Samuel chapter 3 in which he has his first prophecy and he doesn't realize that God is talking to him. And he goes to Eli, his mentor, and thinks Eli has called him. So Maimonides wrote that this was the first time that Samuel Shmuel had a prophecy and he didn't know that that's how prophecy worked. However, Abarbanel says, it is not as the master, the guide, wrote. And then he says, the scholars among the Christians have agreed with this in their books. He presents his own idea of how prophecy works. And he says, the Christians agree with me. He quotes various Christian works in his biblical work, especially the Christian translator Jerome. He quotes. He has greater problems with the Christians in terms of their missionizing. Much of his writing was angled toward refuting their statements when they claimed that the biblical text predicted Christian ideas. He writes his three books that we talked about the Messiah, about Mashiach, in large part to counter what the Christians are trying to say about it. So when you look at, for example, Isaiah chapter 53, which is a chapter that the Christians use to argue that it predicts the Christian Messiah, so he writes at length that it can't possibly, that's the suffering servant section. It can't possibly refer to their Messiah. He goes on at length to debunk it. His approach to commenting on Tanakh. So he believed, we already said, he criticizes the Ashkenazim for not bringing in Midrash. He says that Rashi, on the other hand, is too busy quoting Midrash to engage in his own commentary. He says everything Rashi says, he's quoting from somebody else. I want to hear what Rashi thinks. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, the Sfardi, he says, is too focused on short grammatical notes to actually interpret the lessons of the Torah. And he says, this is a criticism, this is classic Abarbanel. He says, Ibn Ezra's comments are shorter than the verses he's commenting on. He takes that as a criticism. Abarbanel is prolix. He writes and writes and writes and writes. He doesn't stop writing. There's a line which I forget where I first heard this, about a yeshiva student who became a heretic, because every Friday night he would read Abarbanel's commentary on the Parsha. But the way Abarbanel writes his commentary is that he starts with a bunch of questions, 18 questions on the section, and then he gives this long discussion of his ideas and how they fit into the section, how they answer the questions. So the yeshiva student who's studying Abarbanel Friday night only gets to the end of the questions before he falls asleep, and that's why he becomes a heretic in the end. He never gets to the answers. Abarbanel, he wasn't paid for his writing, but if he was, it was totally by the letter, or the page. Well, he criticizes Ibn Ezra for being too brief. He criticizes Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, Gersonides, for going too far into rationalism. He doesn't like that either. He believes that a true commentary has to be long and in-depth and explore all aspects of an issue in great detail in order to derive lessons. The Torah's laws and the Torah's stories are meant to provide deep and enduring enlightenment, and the commentary has to reflect all of that. So his approach is much more thesis. He's not interested in making comments here and there about grammar. He's not interested in just quoting a midrash to explain a particular verse. He wants to give you this kind of overall. And that's the approach that he takes in his writing. There is so much more to say about Abarbanel, clearly. Before I take Claudette's question, I want to note for you on the sheet at the bottom, I gave you a list of books which could be helpful. They come from a range of different writers. I want to highlight for you, David Novak, Local Talent, Covenantal Rights, but also Don Isaac Abarbanel's Stance Toward Tradition, Defense, Dissent, and Dialogue by Professor Eric Lowy, also from Toronto, now made Aliyah. He is excellent. He also actually just came out with a book on Rashi that is supposed to be amazing. Very worth reading. And not about Rashi personally, but about the acceptance of Rashi's commentary and the reaction to it in the Jewish world in his day and beyond. So there's a lot here that, you know, for further reading. There's a lot to be said. Ricky, I see your question in the chat about the difference in Midrash and commentary. Too long for the discussion right now, but Midrash, true Midrash, is an analysis of textual nuance, choice of words, extra words, weird things within text, sometimes weird things within story also, an attempt to get at what is the text really telling me, where there's a pshat read that's much more superficial, how does this fit the story? This looks at it in terms of the text itself. There's a lot more to say about it. Commentary, on the other hand, the term commentary is often used for rabbis who are trying to provide explanations and answers of their own, which will sometimes draw on Midrash and sometimes on different ideas. Okay, Claudette, thank you for your patience.
This is a thought. With all the conversion and the stealing of the children across Europe of Jewish people, I think today if they run a blood test on the most of the population of that region, they will discover a lot of Jewish people.
Yeah, no, it's true. Look, I gave a class, I don't know, 11, no, it wasn't here. It was in Allentown. So I gave a class 15, 16 years ago called Crypto Jews of the American Southwest. It's fascinating stuff. And they find a lot of people who are finding for themselves Jewish heritage among those who came from Spanish speaking countries to the New World. Whether that means they were actually, you know, Jews who were observing and hiding and so on, or just that they had relatives who were, is unclear. But you're right. Jews ended up spreading through the population. Yes, Nurit. Yeah.
In our days, you know, like in the Bible, when we read the Bible, there is commentary of Rashi and other commentaries. Did Abarbanel, I mean, he was a genius, obviously. Did he ever get quoted in any of the
right
Sfarim, maybe?
So the text that you're talking about preceded him. What happens is, in the early days of the printing press, Daniel Bomberg publishes what's called Mikraot Gedolot, and that is it includes commentaries on the biblical text that are earlier. So Rashi makes it into that one as an example. Over time, with new editions of Mikraot Gedolot, additional later commentaries got included. But no one ever included Abarbanel in the page simply because it was too long. You can't fit him in the page. He's bigger than the rest of them combined. Literally, I mean, it's just the way it is. He's a standalone book. In terms of whether the commentators quote him, so again, a lot of the classics, Rashi, Ramban, Sfarno, as Rose pointed out, they're all before him or too early, you know, within his own time to be quoting him. What you do find is later on. So, for example, Rabbi Meir Leibush Wisser wrote the commentary called Malbim on Tanakh. He often quotes Abarbanel. He's writing in the beginning of the 19th century. So you do get later on that they'll quote him, and his work has become very popular today. Okay. I see Leah has a comment in the chat about Portugal. That's perfect, because we're going to transition now to talk about Dona Gracia.